I would not be able to sleep at night. Because my face on that screen, on that Arab news channel, may have been the thing that prompted the person to go in and retaliate or commit an act of terror. The anger in the region is palpable, and it is traumatic. When people are consuming daily images of massacres, of people suffering, and yet they hear that the United States is willfully enabling it by continuing to send bombs, it makes people lose complete faith in the United States. And this is what was so painful to me as an American diplomat. I've worked for the last 18 years to strengthen ties between the United States and other countries, to advance U.S. interests, to promote America's image. But this policy made it impossible. How can we talk about press freedom when we remain willfully silent about the killings of so many journalists? I mean, I personally worked to try to get a statement out on the killing of journalists in Gaza, and I was met with so much pushback. And I was so shocked at my own colleagues that would push back on that. It is a fundamental American value to be promoting freedom of press. We cannot have exceptions. We cannot have double standards. As American diplomats, we need to apply our values, our standards on the situation. That is what we are supposed to be about. And until we do that, we are hurting. I keep on repeating this word, but I fundamentally believe it, and it's a concern of mine that I expressed over the course of months. We're hurting ourselves, not just the Palestinians and not just the Israelis, but we're hurting the United States of America.
You are publicly resigning, but there are others who have simply resigned, saying they don't think they're important enough to announce that they are resigning. Can you talk about the number of people who have left and also who have expressed, like you have through the official channels going all the way up, your concern?
I actually don't know of any others that have resigned within the Foreign Service. There may be, and I may not know about them, but I do not know of any others other than Josh and Anel, who are not service Foreign Service officers, but were Washington-based, that have resigned. But I know for sure that a lot of people express frustrations and of wanting to resign. And I know this mostly from after my own resignation was announced internally. It was quite a surprise to me. I did not know how people would react to me, honestly, when I was still on the inside, because my resignation was announced internally before it became public externally. And at that point, so many people approached me and talked about how they've been so frustrated with the policy. They felt like they couldn't say anything. They felt like they couldn't do anything. They were worried about their careers. They were worried about if they spoke up internally, what would that do to them? And it was very disheartening to hear. It's not what the State Department is supposed to be about. Many told me that they wish they could resign because they really could not keep maintaining every single day under this policy, but they couldn't for financial reasons, for other considerations related to their families. And so it is a sad time within the department. As far as I'm concerned, and I can only share my experience, of course, the State Department is a very large institution, but I can tell you, after 18 years of service, you get to know a lot of members of the diplomatic corps. And it's an unprecedented time. It's very uneasy. And I think everyone wakes up hoping that the next day will be better. But we really do need some fundamental changes to this policy because it is such a failed policy that is just hurting all parties involved.
And your response to President Biden speaking out yesterday for the first time on the college campus unrest, the thousands of students who have been arrested, also professors have been arrested, saying that that protest across the country has no effect on his foreign policy?
Honestly, I was intensely disappointed that he would speak about constituents in that way, that he would speak about voters in that way, that he would speak about Americans in that way. He is supposed to be a representative of the people. And the fact that these students have been dismissed, these students have been labeled, the bottom line is, I think there is a fundamental generational shift in not just the United States, but globally. Because these students, much like people across this region, have been consuming on a daily basis the images coming straight out of Gaza. They've been seeing on their social media feeds the children that have been dying of starvation. They're seeing on their social media feeds the bloody toddlers that are being carried with an arm blown off. They're seeing this on a daily basis. And it took them 7 months to rise. If President Biden, if Secretary Blinken had solved this crisis, there would have been no student protests. The buck stops with the president. Again, I'm going to say it. It is a failed policy. It has not succeeded in bringing home the hostages. It has not succeeded in making Israelis safer. And when students are seeing a potential plausible ongoing genocide, they are reacting to it. They are reacting to the fact that their academic institutions may be financially invested in the killings of innocent people in Gaza. They're reacting to the fact that their government is continuing to enable the killing of innocent civilians. And it is a fundamental democratic right in the First Amendment. And it was very, very disheartening to hear the president just dismissing them that way without even addressing the source of their concerns. Of course, I am absolutely against any type of violence on campus or anywhere else. It should be inclusive. No students, regardless of their religion, of their race, of ethnicity, need to be targeted whatsoever. And that is clear, and that should go without saying. But it is also clear that there was so much community in these protests. There were Jewish students with Muslim students, with Christian students, with atheists, with agnostics. It doesn't really matter. People were unified in calling for an end to the carnage and an end to the violence. And suppressing them in such a violent manner is horrific. And it's also not necessary. Again, as a diplomat, I fundamentally don't believe in solving conflicts through arms or through violence. I believe in sitting down and talking with individuals, sitting down and negotiating, not in suppression.
Hala Rarit, I thank you so much for being with us. Hala Rarit is the first State Department diplomat to resign over the Biden administration's Gaza policy. She is an 18-year career diplomat. This is her first television interview since resigning. Coming up, we speak with two doctors just back from volunteering at the largest functioning hospital in Gaza. Stay with us.
I can see the lines from a town. They are floating on the sky. I'm making my
A Place to Stay by Sam Burton, Palestinian-American singer-songwriter from Salt Lake City, dedicated this song to his Palestinian father. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Nearly 7 months of constant bombardment, siege, and obstruction of aid deliveries have annihilated the healthcare system in Gaza. Last week, the Palestinian Health Ministry said around 600,000 Palestinians in the northern Gaza Strip no longer have access to any kind of healthcare. The World Health Organization has said that Israel is, quote, systematically dismantling the health system in Gaza, save the children's reported Israel's attacks on the healthcare sector and got the rate of 73 attacks per month are higher than in any other recent conflict in the world. Only 11 hospitals out of 36 hospitals in Gaza are partially functioning. In April, Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa, in Gaza City in the north, was completely destroyed following a two-week siege by Israeli forces. Then Gaza's second-largest hospital, Nasser Hospital, was also destroyed following another brutal siege by Israeli forces in Khan Yunis. After their withdrawals, Palestinians found hundreds of bodies buried in mass graves at both hospitals. Now the largest hospital remaining partially operating in Gaza is the European Hospital in Khan Yunis. Like so many other hospitals, it's also sheltering thousands of displaced Palestinians. We're joined now by two doctors just back from Gaza who volunteered at the European Hospital. Dr. Ismail Meir is an anesthesiologist and chair of the nonprofit Imana Medical Relief, which focuses on disaster relief. Dr. Meir has participated in over 35 medical missions globally, has been to Gaza five times dating back to the 2008-2009 war. He's joining us from Hornell, New York. And joining us from Charlotte, North Carolina, is Dr. Azim Elahi, a pulmonary and critical care physician who is part of the team of doctors volunteering at European Hospital with medical relief. Dr. Elahi has participated in several humanitarian medical mission trips to various parts of the world, was previously in Gaza in 2019. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Dr. Meir, let's begin with you. Describe what you saw.
First of all, thank you, Amy, for having both of us. And describe what I saw, a very common question. Immediately when we entered and in the morning went to go to work, the first sight was all the amputees, the children, from children through the adults. Seeing the number of amputees, double amputees, with 30,000 people living outside or inside that hospital was our first sights, the first thing that we saw. And, you know, my experience in Gaza, this was my fifth time there. I had never seen something like this, including my visits to Syria, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen in the past. You know, conflict zones, areas under tense, circumstances. I've never seen this number of amputees, destruction, and people seeking refuge. It was an experience like no other.
If you can tell us about a few cases and also talk about patients coming from other hospitals and what you heard about Nasser and Shifa, this horrifying report we got in the last week of mass graves discovered at both major hospitals.
Yeah, you know, you make a lot of friends as you travel back and forth to Gaza. I mean, people that I was deathly sick and worried about if they were still alive. And when I was at European Gaza Hospital, I ran into some of my friends. I saw them there. They had shifted down from the north, and they shared some of the horrors of Shifa Hospital. They shared that they were there when forces came in and some of the stories and what took place. And they shared with me the name, you know, people that were friends of ours that have passed away, like Dr. Medet, the plastic surgeon who was killed, and Dr. Ahmed, the young plastic surgeon, and his mother were killed at Shifa, and their bodies were found there. They shared those stories with us, and we paused and we grieved, and then we got back to work. Patients, you know, Yasin, 11-year-old boy, was a double amputee. He's 11 years old. You know, I have children. Those watching have children, grandchildren, nieces and nephews. Imagine your 11-year-old family member losing both his legs. And now in Gaza, there were only two prosthetic centers that would help these, you know, amputees throughout the Gaza Strip, and those no longer exist. And as you mentioned earlier, a systematic dismantling of healthcare. You know, we saw it. We incurred it. Every night, we would hear the bombings, the strikes, the drones, the artillery. And like clockwork, myself and Dr. Azim and my other two colleagues, Dr. Shazia and Dr. Shark, would know it's time for us to get to the emergency department. And we would work long hours into the early morning hours, helping the local doctors at European Gaza Hospital try to save lives as mass casualties would come in. Some would be dead on arrival, and some would die while we were working on them, and then others we'd be able to save. And, you know, as we started the show earlier about the recent bombing strike in Rafah, it brought back vivid memories, and I can recall myself and Azim in that emergency department going through what takes place. And to follow up, yes, European Gaza Hospital is the only tertiary, only high-level hospital remaining. It is not a massively huge hospital like Shifa was or Nasser was. And now when strikes take place in other places, there is no place that can stabilize or take care of such mass casualties besides European Gaza Hospital. So from Rafah, they're brought to a European Gaza Hospital, which is probably about 5 to 8 kilometers, probably, and then receive care. So, you know, this is life in Gaza as a healthcare worker right now, trying to deal with all this.
This is a short video your team filmed of some of the children and people taking shelter inside European Hospital. Many of them have set up makeshift tent hallways.
Another day in EGH. Assalamu alaikum. How are you? These are people. They're living in the hospital. Probably another 20,000 at least outside. Hey, how are you? So they've lost everything. They live in the hospitals. They're not patients. Make makeshifts on the side. There's people up on the stairs like this. This is life in Gaza.
That's inside European hospital. Dr. Azim Elahi, if you can describe the atmosphere, not only the patients, but the people taking refuge, and then what people are dying of. You've got the airstrikes directly, but then you also have disease, and you have this imminent famine. Talk about that, Dr. Elahi.
Amy, thank you for inviting us to share our experience. I was listening to that clip in my ears, and immediately a smile came on my face just because it took me back to those moments when we'd walk through the hallways. It's as equally happy as it is sad, because these are displaced people who have arrived to the hospital for shelter, for electricity, for food, with broken families. When you sit down and actually interact with the people that you encounter in these corridors, you realize very quickly that the families are extended families, and they've been brought together because of injured family members or family members who have passed away as a result of the war. The corridors are lined, just like you see in that video, in every nook and cranny, every staircase, every space in the hospital where you're taking care of patients, where the radiologist is reviewing scans, is occupied by displaced persons. The situation there is dire because it does, in fact, interrupt medical care when you have this cohabitation of sterility and medical treatment with just life. And it's a truly amazing parody to see in real life, because you can hear in the video the amazement and the joy and the laughter that you can hear from the children's voices. But when they're tucked in behind those curtains, I can assure you that their life is very different than what their faces show.
And the issue of disease and people weakened by hunger, in addition to the direct, the morbidity from direct strikes.
The type of patients we would admit to the intensive care unit were oftentimes blast injury patients. I'm an adult critical care physician, and when I joined the European Gaza Hospital ICU, I realized majority of our patients were actually pediatric patients. More than 50% of the patients in that ICU were under the age of 16, mainly because they were involved. When these bombings and the bombardment occurs, they're typically in the evening when the family units are sleeping together. And the patients that would make it to the hospital are the lucky ones. And just as Dr. Meher pointed out, many of them would arrive dead, and the few that were able to survive would end up in the ICU. The injuries we would see were trauma-related. So they had brain injuries, subarachnoid hemorrhages, subdural hemorrhages, traumatic brain injuries. They required mechanical ventilation because they weren't able to breathe on their own. A lot of infections, especially if in the postoperative setting, when your nutrition is affected, and this is true in the US, in the UK, as it is anywhere else in the world, every surgeon wants their patient to be as nourished as possible. And we know with clear-cut data that patients who are malnourished, who are higher risk of developing postoperative infections, postoperative morbidity.
I want to put the same question to Dr. Ismail Mehr, the question of the injuries people are suffering either from direct air strike or from disease.
Yeah, I mean, Azeem was just remarkable part member of our team, and was like he was shared in the ICU. My role was, you know, I was in the operating room as an anesthesiologist, but with our experience and our team's experience, we manned the ER quite often. And what I want to really share with the viewers in the world, and my message is it's very sexy to look at the bombings, the strikes, you know, and I share that, I'm being sarcastic, but, you know, that's the world focuses on traumatic stuff. What we forget is a grandmother who died from a urinary tract infection. I had to do CPR on her and code her in the emergency department and then look at her son and say she died. He was like, she just had an infection. Because as you shared earlier, excuse me, there's no healthcare system intact any longer. EGH is bursting at the seams. It's not bursting. It has bursted. And as you and I, when we get sick, or your child or grandchild or niece or nephew or aunt or uncle, you take them to the doctor. Gaza had a healthcare system in place, not always the most robust due to the embargo, but you could still go and see your doctor, get your glucose medicine. There was a gentleman, a mid-aged gentleman, that we had to do an amputation on because he had been barefoot for months, got an infection, learned that he did not take his glucophage or metformin. Those of you who are diabetics or know those medicines, they're for managing sugar. He got gas gangrene of his foot. Came in so late that we thought he was going to die that night. Operated him on early in the morning. He died 6 hours later. What about the 20-year-old patient, I believe her name was Amna, who had fulminant liver failure from hepatitis A? Not even, you know, hepatitis B and C are very severe forms of hepatitis. Hepatitis A is from unhygienic water and food. And she was dying in front of us in that emergency room. The mother who developed a blood clot in her leg because she's been immobile living in a tent, and then she had a pulmonary embolism or a clot to her lung. Every day there were people we were declaring dead in that emergency room who were dying of simple, basic things that in Gaza could be treated. I have seen them treated in Gaza before in my experience, and there's no voice for those people. Yes, people are dying from the strikes every day, but the world is failing to see the implications of those who are unaccounted for.
I want to ask you both to stay with us because we have other questions about how this compares to other medical trips you have made as you volunteer in conflict zones around the world. On Monday, we will discuss the Abu Ghraib decision. So we have to break one more time. So Dr. Ismail Mer and Dr. Azeem Elahi, stay with us. They're just back from volunteering at Gaza's European hospital with the Amana Medical Relief Team. Back in 20 seconds. Sing to the Wind by Naya Barghouti. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with the two doctors just back from Gaza volunteering at European Hospital, Dr. Ismail Mer, anesthesiologist, chair of the nonprofit Imana Medical Relief, which focuses on disaster relief. Dr. Mer has participated in over 35 medical missions globally. He's been to Gaza five times, dating back to 2008 and 2009. And Dr. Azeem Elahi is with us from Charlotte, North Carolina, pulmonary critical care physician, who is just back also from European Hospital. Dr. Mer, you've been in dozens of conflict zones around the world. How does Gaza compare?
There's no comparison. You know, you say you've seen, you know, in a long career that when you've seen everything, you know your career is complete. And I thought at one point that, you know, I've seen everything. And when I walked into Gaza, not even close. No, I can compare it to Gaza 2008, 2009, 2022, 2023. You know, I had the opportunity to go to Derbala. It's a little bit north of Khan Yunis, and I had to drive through Khan Yunis to deliver supplies and medications that we had for different hospitals. And as far as I could see, it looked like Armageddon. There was not a single building, single structure, single gas station, single hospital, single school, single university that remained standing. And then the despair and the that you see around you at European Gaza Hospital, I can't do justice to describe it. I just, maybe Azeem can or someone else can. You can't describe it.
I want to go to one of the people you met at European hospitals. You were just describing Refaat Badouan, describing what he and his relatives were sleeping, targeted by an Israeli strike. His son survived, but severely injured.
My brother and his wife and his all children, two daughters and one son, are killed. Stashadu. Inshallah, Rabbil Alameen. Also, my sister's son are killed by them. We don't do anything. Hasbunallah wa ni'mal wakeel. Our Gaza and all the health sector need your support. There is many injury and there is a shortage in medical supplies. We all need your help.
That's Refaat Badouan, Dr. Mayor. If you can also talk about how Gaza has changed in the many times that you have been there back to 2008-9.
Yeah, I think people fail to forget. Everyone thinks everything started October 7th. This has gone back to 75, 76 years, since 1948. And then Gaza specifically down back to the early 2000s with the embargo. The healthcare system has been always in a noose, and that noose tightens at times when there's conflict, or it loosens up, but it remains around the neck of the healthcare system. And right now that noose has completely hung the healthcare system. I mean, people say partially, people use words as it's semi-functional or remaining hospitals. Yes, there's structures, and there's amazing colleagues and brothers and sisters from healthcare that are doing amazing job. But a functional healthcare system to save lives is been extinguished. It's I can't describe what the situation is there. And that gentleman, Mr. Redwan, he's a pharmacist, and I remember that night vividly, and I'm sure Azeem does as well. It was multiple casualties came in, children with depressed skull fractures, mothers. Some of them were his family members, others were just others, his neighbors. And luckily, our team was there from Imana and Heal Palestine. We partnered with Heal Palestine in this mission, and we were able to work along and help save some lives that night. But what hurts me is that every day this is happening, and every day there are innocent people losing their lives.
Dr. Elahi, I wanted to get your final comment and your message as you come back to your practice in Charlotte, North Carolina, how this has changed you and what you'll be telling the medical community here.
I will say from 2019's experience and our current experience just now, what you'll realize from the people in Gaza is they just want the world to know and understand what they're going through. You heard it in this gentleman's voice that he's just expressing a plea to the world to provide help to the people of Gaza, see what's happening there. And when I come back to the comfort of my home and the comfort of my family and the comfort of a modern healthcare system, it is really difficult to understand what's happening. I think we just have to open our eyes, share with the world what's happening there, and open our hearts for them.
Dr. Azeem Elahi and Dr. Ismail Mayer, back from volunteering Gaza's European Hospital with the Amana Medical Relief Team. That does it for our show. A happy early birthday to Dennis Moynihan. Democracy Now! Produced with a remarkable team. I thank them all. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Dear listeners, as you may have heard, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, is blocking Canadian access to all content created by news providers, including this radio station, in response to the Online Broadcasting Act. Access to local news and information matters to everyone, and while radio stations use their airwaves to keep you informed, we also use social media to share local news, events, and initiatives, and even content about our upcoming programming. We need you to write your MP and convey your concerns. Learn more and find a letter template for your MP on our website. Thank you for your support.
Hi, this is Sukyun Lee, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby.